We had 5 groups. By last evening, we had 11 groups, and this morning it's 13. You guys knew how to, you know, play this game so that I couldn't make it at 8 o'clock.
Those will be nice 2-minute presentations, Mr.
Yeah, that's... Anyway, the other tricky little thing I did was to just have Judith ask you how long each of you'd like to speak. And so far, you've got about 3 hours worth of testimony sitting here in front of me. So you didn't know it when you did this, but what I decided to do was the persons who estimated with the shortest amount of time go first, and we go from there to the longest. How's that? And that might mean somebody will have to come back unless other people move it along.
It's unusual having a preacher run an egg in natural resources. No, usually the sermon, the longer the sermon, they get up first. But
well, no, in my church we take the offering.
No, believe otherwise.
I'm kidding.
Take another 10 minutes. We can cut it down to 1 minute each.
How do we know with people who are all saying that they want to go the same amount of time? You know. I'm going to just have to...
basically the order they signed up.
Thank you.
Okay. The order they signed up. Can you give... This is the order they signed up. Okay, I'm using the fairest system possible then. Given the order that people signed up and the amount of time that they requested, and I'm going to ask everybody to go as fast as they can. There are a couple of these presentations that I know are really good, and I might ask them if they will come back another day, because I don't want people to totally abridge presentations that may have a real bearing on what we're doing in the future. Is Liz Frankel here? Okay. Hers was a very quick 5 minutes or less from the League of Women Voters. I wanted to express her opinions on some of the stuff coming before our committee. And Phil Donovan from the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Guides and Packers has also got a short one, and I'll have him just be in the queue as quickly as possible.
I don't plan to take much time, but I did know that it was important to for you all to understand that the league... Better?
Identify yourself.
Yes, identify yourself, please.
Oh, Liz Frankel, League of Women Voters.
Okay.
The league has 3 action arms. We deal with natural resources, human and social issues, and what we call governance, which you might call good government. So that people sometimes don't quite understand that natural resources is a major portfolio for us. The league, as you probably are aware, is a national organization, has a state level, and has local leagues. General policy is hierarchical. Local leagues can't contradict state or national. On the other hand, if there is no policy, they can study an issue and establish policy. So when I appear before you, I will be speaking for the State League of Women Voters. Mm-hmm. I am their Natural Resources Action Coordinator. Our particular issues this particular session will be, one, a major concern for the role of citizens and how they participate in the legislative process. And this will affect issues related to agency rules, rulemaking, all kinds of stuff. In addition, we have another major concern, and that is we believe that regulation has a value, has an importance. There are things that simply have to be regulated. For example, how fast you drive on the highway. And we all know that we will always drive as fast as the speed limit, perhaps a little faster. Regulation in terms of almost everything else, including natural resources, is equally valuable because what it does is make it possible for all of us to live together in a safe and environmentally sound world. Thirdly, land use, land use, land use. And we are extremely concerned about how the implication of land use, which has been actually existing in this state even before Senate Bill 100, the whole issue of land use and how that plays out is important to us. I was going to go into a lot of principles you will get. We just didn't have time to get you formal statement, but we will give you a formal signed statement, because that's league policy, telling you what our principles are, and you will see a reflection of what I have just explained. That is, we're not just an environmental organization, nor are we just a governance organization, or are we just a social and health organization. Certainly, thank you for this opportunity to help make a statement.
Thank you, Liz. Just keep your folks informed and keep involved.
Don't worry.
What the process is about. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Phil, it's your turn. And I guess since you're from the fishing industry, if you go too long, we can give you the hook, right?
That's absolutely correct.
Oh, it starts already.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for welcoming me here and members of the committee. My name is Phil Donovan. I have a consulting firm called Northwest Public Affairs, and I'm pleased to share with you today that I continue to be retained by the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, which is an industry association of retailers, tackle manufacturers and distributors, all the way down to mom-and-pop bait shops. We'll be working with the Oregon Guides and Packers, which represents over 300 fishing guides, hunting outfitters, and whitewater rafting companies around the state. I also continue my association with the Northwest Steelheaders, 17 chapters with over 2,000 members around the state. These chapters are doing everything from teaching children how to fish, the next generation, if you will, to conducting river cleanups and habitat restoration. Quickly, there will be a few issues that I think will be of interest to this committee that we'll be interested in weighing in on. First off, we'll be closely monitoring how our public lands and waters will be regulated to ensure that these industries that as businesses rely on a healthy environment. We've benefited greatly over the past 2 years of good working relationships with some of our state agencies. I'll refer specifically to the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Director Lindsay Ball and the Commission Chair John Essler, both of which have worked very well with our organizations and the allocation of fisheries and how our different state lands and the regulations that are put in place as it relates to hunting and fishing. Also, like a lot of folks, we're going to be very interested in some of the funding mechanisms that are going to be discussed, specifically House Bill 2260, which would increase hunting and license fees. We were a part of the external budget management committee that was convened by Director Ball. There were 28 members, along with 7 public hearings, attracting over 600 participants. We'll be in support of House Bill 2260, and we'll be monitoring it closely as it moves over here. Another bill that's coming before this committee is Senate Bill 99, which has to do with requiring shellfish tags and or a license to be able to harvest shellfish in the state of Oregon, something that is long overdue. Also, we'll be bringing forward legislation as it relates to over $30 million in backlog maintenance issues at our Oregon hatcheries. There's a dramatic need to keep those facilities up and functional. We've seen years past the Coal River pump breaks down, an entire generation of spring chinook is lost. Finally, I think another issue of interest to this committee will be the management of predators for hunting outfitters across the state. There's a significant concern about herd sizes right now and the effects that predation is having on that. So we'll be watching that legislation very closely as well. That's just a quick overview. I appreciate the opportunity to come in and touch base with you all this morning, and I'll be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Any questions? Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, sir,
for coming in and getting us off to a good start.
At least we didn't have to talk about Ballymage 28, huh?
The Native Fish Society, Les, is here. Let's get him up.
While we're on the subject of fish, Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Les Helgeson. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. We're an organization of approximately 340 people that are dedicated to the conservation of native fish and their habitat. And I thought I'd come and comment on the presentation given last week by the Governor's Natural Resource Policy Advisor and Lindsey Ball from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Now, we heard some good things coming from Mr. Brown, specifically the conservation strategy, I think, is an excellent concept for all agencies. Mr. Brown also addressed the attitude of the agencies. Now, personally, I'm a small woodlands owner and have dealt with numerous agencies. And I can tell you in Tillamook area where I'm from, I live on the upper Nestucca River, I can speak very highly of the personnel there working for Department of Forestry, the forest practice people. They're knowledgeable. They have a good attitude. They know how to work with landowners. I think that needs to be paramount with all agency contacts with landowners. Granted, there are going to be some landowners that you're just not going to deal with, but I think that's the exception and not the rule. So we heard some good things, but I'm a little concerned about suggestions of streamlining the process and going overboard. An example was brought up here of a land exchange in my neck of the woods. Actually, after further investigation, it was down in Yahats area. And that was just a very unusual mistake. As my professional background, I do look at these exchange parcels, particularly for the U.S. Forest Service. My background is in forestry, engineering, and botany. I'm not a bird person per se, but it's confounding how you could miss a bald eagle's nest on a parcel property. They're very large. So I don't know what happened here, and It seems like an unusual circumstance that shouldn't be used as an excuse to unnecessarily streamline some of our regulations, particularly relating to forestry. As I said, I'm a small woodland owner. I've had no problems. And I think that has a lot to do with the attitude issue in particular. Shifting gears now to the fisheries end of things, we're quite concerned about the legislative agenda proposed to you by Director Ball, specifically House Bill 2260. We are not in support of that bill. I believe that the deficit being presented will be exacerbated by a substantial reduction in license and tag sales as a result of this dramatic fee increase. And I've given you some details in my written testimony and some background information from some studies that were done back in 93. In the past, town hall meetings haven't been held, you know, which are by nature political and organized as such. In the past, surveys have been done, objective, scientific surveys asking folks what they'd be willing to pay and so forth. And I've addressed this again in my written testimony here that, at the time, a $1 increase was determined to be about all that the angling and hunting public were willing to absorb. Beyond that, we see a net decrease. As part of the, I observed the external budget advisory committee process, and one of our FishCons members was on there. Staff themselves recommended a level of increase that was approximately half of what's being proposed and was presented to you here because of this very issue of diminishing returns. The committee bumped, ignored that suggestion, bumped it up one level, and then the commission bumped it up another tier, and we're faced with, for example, a $5 increase in the angling license fee itself, which is out of step with past increases given the current economic considerations. Now, where I live on the Nistuckan Pacific City is a huge population of retired folks living on a fixed income. They contribute substantially to our economy there and fishing. And I'm suspecting we could see some unwanted impacts. Another issue that came to light yesterday in the House hearing on this particular bill was that the department in their budget has requested roughly $3 million pay increase, salary increase, and benefit package, which was brought to our attention by one of the committee members. And the governor, of course, has requested that fee increases not happen this session. So I think a lot of the essential services that we would like to see, we are certainly supportive of, number one, Oregon State Police, Fish and Game, and the field personnel. We want to see those remain in place. And by foregoing that $3 million increase, salary increase, we could certainly cover those services without subjecting folks and taking this unnecessary risk. Also, Phil touched on the shellfish license. I think we're supportive of that as well, although I see it written up as an angling license to be required. So is that just going to go into the general fund? And we don't know. So there will be some specifics. We'll be coming back to you with on that, and I appreciate the opportunity to present our position
here. Thank you.
Any last questions?
We're moving on as fast as we can. Dan Wells from the Nurseryman said he wanted 5 minutes. I'm holding you to that. So come on down. And in fact, Marjorie Erie from the Beekeepers Association also is the same amount of time, and so I want her ready next.
Chairman, committee, I thank you for letting me have some time with you this morning. I'll keep it as short as possible. My name's Dan Wells from D. Wells Farms and Nursery, also chair, government relations chair of the Oregon Association of Nurserymen. The nursery industry in the state of Oregon is the largest agricultural community in the state. It also ranks second in the United States behind California. We have recently enjoyed sales close to $700 million, with 80% of that going out of state. We employ somewhere around 23,000 employees. Payroll is $250 to $300 million. The Willamette Valley, with the climate and fertile soils, makes it the best nursery growing ground in the United States. Our nursery industry is open space for quality of life and controlled sprawl of land, which makes it a healthy companion for the state of Oregon. Some issues we feel strongly about in the coming session. Farm labor relation. There is a need to seek organization for our farm laborers, a need of standardized rules for employers and employees. We currently have a draft being written to help. You will see it soon. Minimum wage. The CPAI is written will take the nursery industry out of the competitive market. We must compete for our predominantly East Coast market with other states that pay minimum wage in the $5 range per hour. How can we continue to compete when our expenses keep going up and up? Transportation of our products. In the past, quality plants and competitive sales prices has overweighed the cost of transportation to our customers. With the rising cost of plant material and transportation charges, it will make it an easy financial decision for our customers to go to competitive states like Ohio, North Carolina, and the Tennessees. While we are discussing transportation, there is a need to centralize the overweight, overlength, and other transportation permits for the trucks coming into many counties rather than the separate county permits that are now required. We need to be able to purchase one state permit to travel in all counties. pesticide reporting. Fix it or get rid of it. There are water issues of importance to us for long-term transfer of rules. The nursery industry has enjoyed great working relationships with the Department of Agriculture. We look forward to working closely with the new director, Katie Koba. We are excited about Governor Kulongowski's commitment to the importance of agriculture to the economy and the quality of life in Oregon. These are only a few issues coming in the following year. I cannot stress strongly enough the cost of labor, transportation, and regulatory issues will only help squash revenue for Oregon nurseries. Our business, like others, is based upon competition. Unlike many Oregon businesses, our competition is other states with like markets. We must be given the tools to help us compete. Thank you for your time and consideration on these matters. The Oregon Association of Nurserymen wishes you smooth and a prosperous session. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan, and also Mark Simmons back there. I'm glad you're here this morning. Marjorie Erie was next. Is she here in the room?
Mm-hmm.
Come on down. Fortunately, Senator Corcoran isn't here, so there'll be no stinging commentary on the Beekeepers Association.
I'm sorry for him. I'm Marjorie Erie with the Oregon State Beekeepers Association and also Oregon Women for Agriculture. I really appreciate this opportunity. It's very important that we get this before you, since the bill has not been in yet. And I also want to just make the comment that I agree with everything that Dan Wells said. This is so important to agriculture and natural resources. The testimony I have to bring you this morning is about the OSU Applied Pollination Biologist Apicultural Extension Specialist position. I didn't realize that that was such a long title when I started working on this. 30 years ago, my husband and a few other beekeepers worked two sessions of legislature to get this position approved and at Oregon State. There hadn't been anyone in this position for 30 years before. So as beekeepers, we had no statistics or information to give growers at all that was up to date. And when we had questions, there was no one to go to. Oregon is very unique in its type of agriculture. It's very diversified, and we pollinate rather than we're pollinators rather than honey producers in general. And we go into a tremendous amount of crops, fruits, vegetables, seed crops. In fact, over a third of the food that we eat is directly a result of insect pollination. $500 million of farm income is the direct result of bee pollination. And I would hope that you will support the position, renewing the position. Oregon State has notified, like they did Rangerland Department, that the entomology department would be done away with. And we desperately need this position. I believe it can be put in another department and handled, but it's desperate for Oregon beekeepers. We are not like Iowa or Louisiana or Maryland in beekeeping. We are pollinators, and it's completely different. If they were to come here as beekeepers, they'd have to learn beekeeping completely over. We're just very, very unique, as all of agriculture in Oregon is. I thank you for this opportunity, and I hope that you will support this bill when Fred does introduce it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I recently received some information regarding all the different categories of professorship, or whatever you want to call it, at OSU. Mm-hmm. And I saw absolutely nothing in there that would lead me to believe that there was anyone there that was familiar or was trained in any way in the art of beekeeping. Is that your observation also?
No. Dr. Burgett has been in this position for 28 years. Before that, it had been dropped, and there was no one actually working on beekeeping. But that's why we worked so hard 30 years ago to get this position.
But I mean under this new...
Oh, right. Under...
I know absolutely nothing.
Yes,
that would lead me to believe
nothing.
There was any place for you to go to...
Right. And that's why it's so important.
On a scientific level,
right.
I may not be putting this right, but I didn't see anybody there with any, what it looked to be, any experience or any knowledge.
There would be no one. And when we need research or something here in Oregon, there just is no one to go to without that position available.
Well, thank you for bringing it to our attention this morning.
Thank you.
We'll keep an eye on it. Let's see. I'm doing everything I can here. Is Sheldon Pratt here? 5 minutes. Can you do it?
I can do it.
Okay, come on down. He was one that we didn't have a time for, and that's the last of the ones that wanted to go early that had 5 minutes apiece, and then we're going to move to a little longer presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to walk you very quickly through what a commodity commission here in Oregon looks like. I'm Sheldon Pratt. I live here in Salem. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Dairy Products Commission. In this session, we will be dealing with an update and some housekeeping legislation addressing Oregon Commodity Commission. Commodity commissions, of which there are 28, represent the various commodities in the state, were formed at the initiative or support of the dairy industry, in our case, or the commodity industry, were funded strictly by the industry we represent and support. In my case, it's the dairy industry. Every dairy producer in the state of Oregon pays an assessment to our commission. Every processor in our state pays an assessment to the commission. No general funds whatsoever. We function as an industry and economic development entity for our Oregon dairy industry. Dairy industry in our state is about a $315 million industry farm gate. You can trip, and most of our production is processed here in the state, with the exception of Malheur County, which goes over into Idaho. Not to get into the specifics of the bill, those will come up later, but the question will probably come up, and I think this is a good time to address it. What is an Oregon Commodity Commission? As I mentioned, there's 28 of us. The Dairy Commission has been in business for over 50 years. I'm going to take a few minutes very briefly to walk you through some of the aspects of what we as the Dairy Products Commission do. When I say we, in the case of this discussion, I'm not talking about all commodity commissions, particularly when I talk about dollar levels. I'm talking about Dairy Farmers of Oregon, Oregon Dairy Products Commission specifically. You have a packet before you. I'll walk through that very quickly. Some of the things we do are very visible and identifiable to us. A lot of the things we do are not that evident, and those are some of the areas I want to touch on. First of all, the Got Milk campaign. Got Milk has been an international phenomenon. It has become literally a textbook case of market development. The Got Milk logo has appeared on every medium known to man. It speaks for itself. Fluid milk consumption in the state of Oregon, driven by this campaign, is number two nationally, number two only behind the state of Utah. Moving to cheese, 40% of our milk produced here in Oregon ends up in cheese, predominantly Tillamook cheese, but we are seeing a developing cottage industry of what we call farmstead cheese producers. As a products commission, we cannot do branded advertising. I cannot take commission funds and run a campaign for Tillamook, for example. We do generic promotions, and towards that end, we are developing and have developed what we call a genuine Oregon cheese label. It is currently in newspaper, women's magazines, and additionally we do display contests, ad cons, in-store demos, the whole gamut. In your packet, you will see a consumer piece we produced talking about and promoting Oregon, genuine Oregon cheese, recipes in the middle, and then we've done some cross-promotion on the back with great cheese pairs, tying into some of our other industries here in the state of Oregon. This next document in your packet, it actually looks like a copy of a CD. It's actually what we call a bottle topper. Brand new campaign we're working on. It is a plastic ring that goes around a gallon jug, goes around the neck of that, and you can see it is a cents off coupon for Oregon cheese. We have a national partner on this, Sara Lee. It goes, as I say, around the gallon jugs. It's a test market. We're trying to spike fluid milk sales and also promote the sale of Oregon cheese. Right now, we've got it in a test market that will roll out in all of the Albertson stores in Oregon. We're having that private label pack by Alpenrose in the Portland area and Umpqua Dairy Products down in the southern Oregon area. Most of the cost of this are paid by Sara Lee. If this is successful, we hope to roll our marketing campaigns for Oregon cheese out into other key markets around the state, or excuse me, around the country. We're trying to take Tillamook nationwide. We spend $650,000 a year in nutrition education materials. The Oregon Dairy Council is our nutrition education arm. And the next item you see is a brochure, a catalog of the various materials we have. We have consumer, health professional, and educational materials. We have educational materials in virtually every school in the state of Oregon. If you glance through it, you can see that we have everything from consumer to all of the various levels of education. We, as the educational community, continue to change, have to keep up with technology. You see on page 4, we're doing more and more with CD-ROMs for in-school resources, classroom, preschool, we have middle school, we have high school. One of the most rapidly growing areas, and it's a response to requests from schools, and that is what you see on page 10. We list as multicultural resources. Many of our more popular campaigns, we have gone into bilingual programs, and we're selling those at cost or at a subsidized cost to schools. Moving forward, we've all heard about, and looking at page 14, we've all heard about the childhood obesity crisis we have in this state. We just started a new campaign on that, and you see that up there for both male and female teens. The campaign's called What's Normal Supposed to Look Like Anyway? We have a Pyramid Plus teen body image posters. It's been a phenomenal campaign. We're selling those materials statewide. I'm sorry, U.S.-wide. We give them to schools in the state of Oregon. We provide them at cost to units around the country. So that's some of the obvious things we do. Moving over to the other side, you see a spacewalk in an astronaut in a space suit. Behind U.S. Bank, we are the number 2 business or corporate sponsor partner with Oregon School Activities Association. The ad here is very simple, and what we've been doing, we're in our 6th year of that. We sponsor what we call the Academic All-State Program. And the ad says, some of today's athletes might score their biggest wins on a field like this. Nearly 100,000 high school students participate in sports and other OSA activities. Whether on a basketball team or on a choir, they learn the value of hard work and cooperation with goal and other goal items to meet goals. Together with academic achievement, these values and life skills are any student's foundation for future success. This year, the OSAA Academic All-State Team Awards will recognize high school teams based on grade point averages, regardless of win-loss records. At the Dairy Farmers of Oregon, we're proud to promote fitness and athletics with high-quality dairy products. High-quality, equally pleased to be the sponsor of this OSA program that also promotes excellence in the classroom. I can tell you that this year we're going to have 2,155 teams from around the state high school teams participate in that, and we will have 32,861 high schoolers receive awards, individual awards from us, and also a school trophy. How's it working? Every year, the academic standards increase. This fall,
The lowest team, we had a tie for fall sports 2002. Sandy Ann Christian and Tillamook High School for football tied. That was our lowest GPA for that team, and it was an astounding 3.61 GPA. The winner, the highest, was Grant High School. That was the girls' cross country. It was a 3.98. We have had perfect 4 points. It's a program that has been very well received. A letter in there from the president's office of from OSU. We provide over $90,000 of support each year to various research academic support programs at OSU. Excuse me, I dropped my glasses. And we will continue to do that. We have also pledged $50,000 to the support or establishment of an endowed chair at OSU that will be used for supplies and graduate student support. School milk service has been a problem. We provide in the next packet, you see a grant to all schools that wanted in the state of Oregon to provide milk coolers for their cafeterias. We've got them statewide. It helps address the quality of the milk. You see a couple of pictures there, one from a LeGrand High School and one from a Eugene High School. Milk vending in schools, we know where the top folks have been. We know that the schools depend heavily on those Pepsi and Coca-Cola contracts. We know the nutrition education people are concerned about the sugar, the lack of calcium. We did test pilot with the Portland schools, put 9 machines in. It worked very well. As a result of that, we now have a statewide program where we're supplying $500 to any school towards the purchase or lease of a vending machine, milk vending machine. We have them virtually statewide right now, many in the Portland area, and we have 5 in the Southern Oregon area. Colored picture of one of our milk vending machines. How am I doing?
Ran out of several minutes ago.
Okay. Miscellaneous things, we do fundraising for various charities, the Cows for Kids campaign, working with other corporate leaders such as Nordstrom's and Nike's. We did a Cow for Kids contest and raised $2.1 million to New Avenues for Youth and Trillium Youth Services. So that is a very quick tip of the iceberg of what we are all about. Pardon for being a little long. Excuse me.
That's okay. I threw you a curveball by asking you to try to do it in 5 minutes, and I know you have lots to say. I know the Dairy Products Commission does a lot of things, and thank you for kind of going through the overview because it gives us an idea of what all commissions do at different levels.
The various commissions are as diverse as the industries they work for.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to ask John Ledger if he'll come up next. His is a little longer presentation. We just want you to get moving as fast as you can, okay? And Hillary Abram is next. She also indicated the same length as John, so we just got to keep moving here.
This one come on?
Yeah. There it is.
Wait and see how those things work.
Members of the committee,
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. What I'm going to give you is sort of a framework for what you'll be seeing the rest of the day, because these are things that you normally don't see, but I thought I'd scoot through them fairly quickly, because I think it gives you a sense of where the state is. So I'm going to talk a little bit about where we've come from and where we're going, because I think sometimes it's a surprise to people. We looked at exceedances of the EPA air quality standards. Those are standards of ambient air, health-based, that if you violate, then the area is in non-attainment. All kinds of bad things happen. And in the year, you really can't see it very well, but on the far left, on the bottom, it's 1985, and you can see we have almost 200 exceedances a year. It was a mess. And that dropped precipitously until on the bottom, on the far right-hand corner, we're in 2002, and we might have had 2 exceedances. So it went to 0 and bumped along the bottom. Those 2 exceedances on the bottom, the red dot on the very bottom, that bump of 2, was due to forest fires. And one of the things you'll see from this is if you want to improve the environment, the air quality and water quality in this state, the best thing you can do is manage the forests. If you're looking at tonnages, because it pretty much dwarfs everything else. The black line is the change in the population of the state, kind of by percent, so you can see the population of the state's growing, but our air statewide is getting much better. This is a big success story. This is an EPA chart. Nitrous oxides, these are general industrial emissions, and you can see they, from 1900, they increased, and they peaked around 1970. And this is something you're going to see over and over again. Emissions in air and water tended to peak around the 70s, and they've been dropping since. In this case, VOCs, which are volatile organic compounds, any organics, sulfur dioxides and nitrogen oxides. And there's been a big drop, and that's been continuing. The emissions have gone down dramatically in the last 30 years. We've seen the same thing on the water side. This is from DEQ. This is off their webpage. And this is what they call their streams index. And on the left-hand side on the axis, it's percent of streams in the state. And along the bottom is year. And the green line is the percent of streams that are getting better. And you can see at one time, about 1990, only about 10% of the streams were getting better. And you look now, when this last data here is 1998, about 70% of the streams are getting better. And even more important, when you look at the red line, the number of streams that are getting worse, in 1990, about 20% of the streams were getting worse year to year. And you see that going to about zero. So the streams are getting better across the board. These people are putting in a lot of work. Everyone talks about the Willamette River. Again, a little hard to see. This is dissolved oxygen levels in the Willamette River, the lower Willamette. High is good. Low is bad. Bad for fish. And you can see in 1960, they're very low. The dissolved oxygen levels in the river have gotten better over the last years. And this is all DEQ data. I want to show you quickly where, according to the DEQ, pollutants come from. Most of them come from me, because I do things like I wash my car on the street and the suds go down the drain into the river. And I live in a neighborhood where if your lawn isn't really green, you get hung in effigy or worse. So I put enormous amounts of pesticide on my lawn, which runs into the creek behind my house. When you look at where does pollution come now in the state, this little blue slice over here on the air side is what DEQ says comes from the industrial base. It's around 7%. The biggest piece on the air side is transportation by far. And if you went and you looked at the data from DEQ on what part of this air pollution comes from forest fires, not prescribed burning, but forest fires, it's about, I'd say, two or three times the industrial slice. Because you're looking at enormous tonnage from these wildfires. On the water side, it's similar. A lot of runoff from urban areas. The blue slice is industry plus municipalities. Again, these are DEQ figures. But the thing to remember here, I think that's important, is these pies, the piece of the pie, the size of the pie, is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So if you looked at this pie 20 years ago, the slices might be the same, but the pie would be a lot bigger. Because I think we're doing a lot of good work in ag and forestry and on the industrial side. And now we're starting to catch up on the urban areas. Air toxics, there's been a lot of air toxics. Talk about air toxics. We're working with DEQ on a new regulatory program now that we'll probably endorse if we can keep everybody on board. These are EPA's 33 priority air toxics and sources. Again, most of the problems transportation that we have to deal with. Industrial is about 9%, and then the other is what we call area sources, home heating, small commercial operations. So when we look at doing new regulatory programs on the industrial side, you're looking at squeezing it out of here. Okay. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but this is kind of a schematic of the regulatory scheme we're under now on the industrial side. In water, we have TMDL development going. We're going to have new permits written for most of the facilities. It's going to cost millions of dollars, a lot of it on the Willamette, much for mercury, temperature, other things. We have just general federal standards and requirements that are in federal law. We have state-only requirements, and these are programs that are not required by state law, but we're required to do. On the air side, it's a very similar thing. What EPA did some years ago was they went through the whole country and they picked out the top 12% performers in each category, like of a steel mill or a pulp and paper. And then they say everybody has to come up to that level. It's called maximum available, maximum achievable control technology. So we're having that roll through our industrial sources now, where they're having to retrofit and put on new controls. After they're done with that, and that's all done, then EPA will come back and say you have to do residual risk, which is you look at the whole thing all over again to see what the health effects might be, and then that unloads another set of regulatory requirements. And then we have the regular federal standards and also the state-only programs, which are programs not required by the federal government but are required by the DEQ. So this is going to go for another 20 years. DEQ is supported primarily by fees and federal money, gets very little general fund money. This chart is a chart of how fees have increased over the years. It's cumulative. On the bottom left, on the bottom axis, 1989, which is the base year we used. The blue line on the bottom is inflation. So you could see on the far right, 1901, you know, inflation's been about 45% since 89. And water permitting fees have gone up around almost 300%, and air permitting about 500%. We have supported these. These are penalties assessed by the DEQ, not what's recovered. We don't have that data yet, but this is assessed. And across the bottom, you can't really see it, but this right here is 1991, and this is 2002. And as you can see, there's been actually an increase in penalties assessed. Part of it, I think, was to catch up for this year. But when you hear people come in and say, we need a program to increase DEQ penalties, I mean, they're going up on their own. Okay. It's adequate. So, you know, in summary, this is what we want to see. Number of air quality violations dropping, bumping along the bottom. Percent of streams that are getting better going up. One of the things we'll be working on with DEQ over the next 6 months is they're coming out with a major regulatory program dealing with hazardous air pollutants. And I think it's going to look pretty good because it's going to deal with things on a geographical level, you know, looking at all sources. We've worked with DEQ on this for about 4 years along with a huge stakeholder group, and it's been a sometimes brutal process. And we think it's going to go in the right direction. We don't want people dropping off. And I think that's one of our concerns about kind of extra regulatory stuff like some of the mercury proposals we're seeing. So with that, that's all I have, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? John, we're just glad to have you coming this morning from Associated Oregon Industries. It's good to have you over there. And thank you for that perspective and overview of what you think we're doing here. I'd already called Hillary Abrams to come and be next, so I realize that we got a lot more people that signed up in the last 24 hours, and it's squeezing our time, so I just ask you, Hillary, to move through as fast as you can. Is that okay? Welcome. Glad you're here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hillary Abraham. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Nature Conservancy of Oregon. The Nature Conservancy is an international nonprofit organization dedicated to conservation. Our mission is to preserve the plants, animals, and natural communities that represent the diversity of life on Earth by protecting the lands and waters they need to survive. Using non-confrontational, market-based solutions to protect critical habitat, we purchase and manage land and form partnerships with other landowners, both public and private. The Conservancy was founded in 1951 by a professional association of ecologists seeking to turn their knowledge of nature into positive action for conservation. The Oregon office opened in 1961, and today the Conservancy has nearly 1 million individual members nationally and approximately 25 member households in Oregon. To date, our organization has helped to protect more than 9 million acres in all 50 states in Canada and has helped local partner organizations preserve millions of acres in 29 countries. In Oregon, we own or cooperatively manage 47 preserves and have helped to protect more than 340,000 acres of our state's most biologically important habitat. Three principles have been fundamental to our success. They include sound science, strong partnerships with public and private landowners, and tangible results at local places. The Conservancy is committed to ecoregional-based conservation as the most effective, scientifically sound means of ensuring the success of our mission. Ecoregions are large areas of land and water that are defined by such factors as relatively uniform climate, topography, geology, and vegetation. Ecoregional planning guides the Conservancy's acquisition and restoration efforts to ensure the lands we protect have the highest conservation values. Once lands have come under our management, conservation staff create a site conservation plan, including identification of conservation targets, challenges to ecological health, strategies for addressing those challenges, and tools to measure our success to achieve conservation goals. And in the interest of time, I will skip over the examples, but I'd encourage you to refer back to them if you'd like later. Our preserves are living laboratories. Not only do these sites assure long-term protection for native plants, fish, wildlife, and ecosystems, but they also provide a high level of community benefit. Many of our preserves provide both the science-minded researcher and the layperson an opportunity to better understand the workings of nature, as well as our restoration plans and activities. The Conservancy protects habitats by working with private and public landowners to find cooperative solutions that will conserve natural areas for future generations. We do this by working with only willing sellers and by purchasing lands, accepting gifts of land, and conservation easements and management agreements. Although we are not required to by law, because we see ourselves as partners in the communities where we work, we always pay property taxes in rural counties where our ownership has a measurable impact on the local tax base. We have invested over $90,000 in contributions back into these communities. Additionally, these 47 preserves serve as habitat restoration focal points in the states where local people are hired in partnerships with us in the daily restoration efforts unique to each of our sites in our portfolios. So for the 2003 legislative session, part of the Conservancy's focus is similar to others. Like many, we share in our state's overall concern regarding budgets and the effects these cuts will have on the state's ability to do their work. Our hope is to continue to work with you and other members of the Legislative Assembly to develop fair and practical solutions to address Oregon's current economic challenges. There are, however, three specific areas where we will focus our energy this session. The first is securing some stable funding for noxious weed removal. As many of you know, noxious weeds create a huge cost to Oregon, both ecologically and economically. According to the state noxious weed plan adopted by the House Agricultural Committee in 2001, noxious weeds cost Oregon an estimated $83 million annually. These impacts hit every farmer, rancher, and landowner in the state and have the potential to devastate a variety of other agricultural industries in Oregon. Equally, noxious weeds pose a huge challenge to achieving ecological restoration goals for the critical habitats the Conservancy is trying to protect. During the 2002 interim, the Conservancy served on the State Noxious Weed Task Force, a coalition formed by House Agricultural Chair Representative Jeff Krupp during the 2001 session. The charge of the task force was to explore potential funding sources to fund weed eradication programs in the state and then recommend these through legislation to the 2003 legislature. In partnership with a host of individuals and organizations, including the Cattlemen's Association, the Farm Bureau, and Oregon Association of Counties, we explored a number of funding mechanisms that were not general funded, but rather sources tied to the introduction of weeds. In addition to securing revenue, the bill seeks to create a structure to get dollars on the ground to benefit local communities for whom noxious weeds are a real hardship. Our draft legislative concept was submitted by Representative Bob Jensen. Unfortunately, there are some problems with it as written. My hope is that our efforts to address some of the concept's problems will be easily addressed and that I may be sitting before you again before too long presenting it. Another area of focus for the Conservancy is the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Since its statutory implementation in 1999, we have seen the on-the-ground benefits to local communities that OEB dollars provide. Not only do these lottery dollars provide a non-regulatory approach to addressing endangered species issues, but they also help to provide economic stimulus to Oregon's local economies. OEB dollars and their federal counterpart, the National Marine Fisheries Service's Pacific Salmon Program, are making a vital contribution to the on-the-ground restoration work of soil and water conservation districts, watershed councils, and others. We feel good about the kinds of investments OEB has made thus far and hope Oregon will continue to benefit from this non-regulatory approach to the on-the-ground restoration. Finally, the Conservancy is also interested in working with interested legislators, the Oregon Department of Forestry, and other interested constituent groups to advance a discussion regarding the Forest Legacy Program. As many of you already may know, the Forest Legacy Program is a federal program run by United States Department of Agriculture's Forest Service. The program works in partnerships with states, providing opportunities for private landowners and local communities to work together to conserve forest lands. The program is voluntary and focuses on working forest lands, which could otherwise be lost to conversion to non-forest uses. Forest Legacy promotes active and sustainable management to reflect the landowner's objectives where the landowner can, but is not required to, commercially harvest timber. The federal guidelines for Forest Legacy require the state to write an assessment of need. This assessment of need provides an overview of Oregon's data relative to forest land's current rate of conversion, defines key Forest Legacy areas, and establishes criteria to rank projects for Oregon to submit for federal funding. To date, Oregon's AON has already been approved by the United States Secretary of Agriculture. In order to move forward with this program, it is my understanding that members of the legislature would like to have a broader discussion about the program. As a member of the Oregon Forest Lands Coordinating Group and former chair of the Forest Legacy Subcommittee, I would be very happy to participate in any discussion the legislature sees fit on this issue. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Are there any questions? I think we've decided to hold all our questions this morning, getting through as long a list as we can, but we appreciate you coming, as with all of the others. It's been a real diverse kind of gathering of data this morning, but we want to hear from you throughout the session. So
Thank you very much for your time.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask Ralph to come up. I know his is a longer presentation, but he was the very first one to ask to make a presentation 2 weeks ago when I first announced this. This morning, several others have come in and asked if they can testify. And so, Ralph, I'm going to ask you to try to move along as fast as you can so we can still get to a few others at the end of this. Okay?
I'll try to move as fast as I can and still cover the points. First, for the record, I'm Ralph Saperstein. I work for Boise Cascade Corporation. And with me is Russ McKinley, who also works for Boise. Boise has 600,000 acres of forest land in Oregon. Russ is responsible for managing those lands in western Oregon. And the lands we're going to talk about today are under Russ's guidance. We also have approximately 3,000 employees in Oregon working at 15 manufacturing plants throughout the state. We make a wide variety of products. One of the things we make are building products, and that's what comes from our trees. We also supply paper and office products in Oregon. And in fact, the paper that the legislature uses comes from Boise Cascade Office Products. So we've tried to become a diverse company. I will get started. I think that that Russ's purpose here is to provide answers rather than my normal mode of making things up when I don't know. And so Russ will be your expert. Both of us work for Boise, but this issue really transcends Boise, and we are involved in the Oregon Forest Industries Council as committee chairs, and we not only have our committee support, but the board of the OFIC support. And just to support that, you could subpoena anybody in the audience, because there's two OFIC staff members and Weyerhaeuser who would hopefully agree with what we're saying. This matter is not germane just to Boise. It involves all industrial forest landowners. In 2002, the Timber Rock fire showed us that private forest lands are really at risk. Federal lands present a serious fire risk to private forest lands. Poor forest health on federal lands has led to unnatural fire-susceptible lands. inadequate reforestation on federal lands yields flammable brush fields. Hundreds of thousands of recently burned acreage may also in the future become additional fire hazards. And I'll try to not leave the acronyms. The United States Forest Service fire suppression effort is inadequate. That's our federal effort. Fire destroys fish and wildlife habitat also. And as I said, last year, 2002, provided a real-life example of all this in the Timber Rock fire. And we would rather be making this presentation to you out on the Timber Rock fire. And we have an open invitation to the committee or any of you individually after the session on weekends, whenever you'd like, to show you this. We had the governor down, and like I said, we've invited folks. We had lots of folks, scientists and elected officials out, because it's an important issue. We feel that this issue is a vital stimulus for Oregon's economy. Improved federal forest management is one main factor, we think, that will help the economic rebound of the state, versus poorly managed federal forests that are endangering Oregon's non-federal forests and rural communities. And most pertinently for you folks, state budget cuts could reduce private as well as federal funding for fire suppression and prevention. This doesn't count against my time, does it? Because it's a state computer.
So you're not going to be charged for any delay.
Right, that's exactly right, because it works much quicker at home. The Timber Rock fire, and that's what you're looking at, it was a lightning-caused fire that began on July 13th, and there was many lightning strikes throughout the state. It's near the Umpqua Divide on the border of Douglas and Jackson counties. At the confluence of the Umpqua and Rogue River National Forests. The United States Forest Service began working the fire from the top of Timbered Rock. This is a map of the ownership of the Timbered Rock area. The white at the top part, the north part, is National Forest land. And then all of this, the green is land that was owned by Boise. The yellow, that color yellow, is Bureau of Land Management, or BLM lands. And these are O&C lands, lands that came from the building of the Oregon and California Railroad that reverted back to the counties, and now the Bureau of Land Management manages them. You can see the checkerboard ownership pattern, which is typical throughout Western Oregon. The Timber Rock fire grew from just 6 acres on the Forest Service to 20 acres onto the BLM land, which BLM lands are protected from fire under a contract with the state of Oregon. So that allowed the state to get involved. On July 18th, the Douglas Forest Protection Association determined that the Southwest Oregon, the state crew, was in a better position to fight the fire. On July 19th, district team was making good progress, but the fire and big timber makes air support less than an advantage. July 22nd, the team was within a few hundred yards of completing the fire trail around the fire when there was a helicopter crash in the late morning, and that delayed folks that were working on the fire and trying to rescue the passengers on the helicopter. So it was really a perfect storm sort of situation that prevented us.
At that point, it was 30 acres. We want to interrupt for one question real quick that Senator Meyer has.
Could you, on the slide, there was a map. Is the orange dot here where the fire actually started?
Yes.
Okay. See, I would have made it up and said yes, but he said yes. On July 24th, the Oregon Department of Forestry Team 1 is in place and managing the fire from their command center. On July 25th, the weather changed, winds increased, and the fire exploded out of control. The firefighting resources for the state were already stretched thin by numerous fires throughout the state. By day 24, which is August 5th, the fire burned over 27,000 acres and cost $12 million to suppress. 6.2 of that was the state, and 5.8 was federal, and that's paid for under the Federal Emergency Management Act?
Yes, FEMA.
The United States Forest Service firefighting policies and procedures collide with private forest land neighbors, and wherever there's federal forests in this state or anywhere in the region, that they are next to private forest lands. The fire burned over 12,000 acres of private forest land owned by Boise, Superior, and Rough and Ready. About 6,000 acres were in 20 to 30-year-old trees. These are young forests that have no salvage value today. And if you do a calculation of what the future value, and that's the PV, the present value, what that future value would be, it's $5 million in lost forest value, which that's a monetary sign, but foresters lost 20 to 30 years of investment, emotional investment, in trying to grow the best trees possible on that site, and the fire just wiped that out. And there's nothing we can do but start over and hopefully not run into the same problem, which we're going to talk about. And, of course, this does not include damage to private forest land, wildlife, and fish habitat. Streamside zones and buffers were also burned, not to mention the improvement projects that Boise and others have done to try to improve stream use. And what we saw from this fire is that the buffers themselves, these areas of green trees around the streams, really are vulnerable to wildfires and can allow the fire to spread rapidly. They serve as a wick where they suck the fire down and they burn to another area just by having these buffers. And we're under, not as much now, but in the previous federal administration, we were under intense pressure to increase the size of our buffers on state and private forest land, and now we see that could just increase the fire hazard because those buffers are very flammable. And as I mentioned, the stream improvement projects, they also burn up, and that's what we're looking at this picture, is logs that were placed in the creek to improve the salmon habitat by encouraging gravel to form behind the logs. They burn up. And there's our governor down on one of the streams that suffered damage because the fire came right through and burned not only the buffer but all of the stream enhancement projects. Some of the key points that we need to keep in mind on this is that the wildfire could have been controlled in the first 5 days. Now, the Forest Service, unlike the Oregon's Department of Forestry and the BLM, they do not have effective local control processes for aggressive initial attack and wildfire suppression. Their overly restrictive regulations and procedures include things like flight hour restrictions on the use of helicopters, limits on hours of firefighting personnel during the initial attack of the wildfire. These things prevent them from rapid suppression of the fires. Tactical disadvantages due to restrictions on using bulldozers and road closures also contribute to their lack of success in putting fires out. Aerial retardant capability is low, and it's going to be worse for next season because of grounding of C-130 ships, and despite the water that's coming down today, there's not a lot of snow on the mountains, and so we may be facing an even worse situation in 2003. We would hope that as a result of last summer's fires that the Forest Service would reorganize its initial attack strategy and resources, enter into cooperative arrangements with local forest protection associations along with the Department of Forestry and the BLM. They need to place a greater emphasis on protecting intermingled forest land ownership, especially backcountry forest land. They need to invest in its Oregon-based aircraft and helicopter fleet to maintain peak performance and quick response. That's I mentioned the aerial retardant, is that because of cost-cutting and other issues, the Oregon is really taking a back seat to the future of federal aerial fire protection. And what we're looking at here is the future of timbered rock. And this is not a picture of timbered rock. This is a picture of what we don't want to happen on timbered rock. Because we believe that without the use of intensive forestry tools like herbicides, rehabilitating the burned area will be difficult. What we're looking at is BLM land that was burned in 1994 in what was called the Whole Mountain Fire. And we think that it was unsuccessful reforestation because they didn't use herbicides. The alternatives they used instead of herbicides were ineffective and very expensive. And this, what we're looking at is basically a brush field. There's very few conifer trees. And the problem with this, besides losing that forest resource, we think that's very flammable. And so it will, if that's what the timber rock area grows up to be, it'll burn our forest land again. And so if we spend money and invest another 15 or 20 years in those trees, we may lose them again because the fire return history in southern Oregon is very short. It's the same issue anywhere in the West, but in southern Oregon, the fire returns more frequently. But the same issue could be said anywhere you have national forests that aren't being regenerated. Another alternative is, and this goes for all private forest land owners, but what we're looking at is Boise forest land, and you need to understand that Boise has better forest land than any other private forest land owner, but you could try to make the same scenario. But this is
some disagreement.
This is some of our land that was also burned in that fire in 1994, and we used scientific research that was developed in southern Oregon to figure out how we can grow trees again, because it's very difficult in southern Oregon because water is very scarce and there's lots of competing vegetation. But we have been successful in growing a new stand, which we think is a lot more fire safe than a brush field. And as I said, we have sort of unanimity within the industry and the Oregon Forest Industries Council that we think the most important thing is that we need to abate the fire threat from federal lands to adjacent private forest lands. We do this by examining Forest Service prioritization of fire suppression activities. And this is a complicated thing, but the priority that the federal government has in terms of putting out fires is different than the state of Oregon's. And the bottom line is that resource protection or protection of forest land is the lowest priority for the federal government. And human life is top priority for both agents, for both the federal government and the state, but resource protection is the lowest priority for the federal government. And we think the managing forest health to reduce fire susceptibility is key, that we need to get our federal forests in a healthier situation. And then once they are burned, we need to rehabilitate and reforest and salvage those lands for the future. That's all I have. I'd be glad to defer any questions to Russ if you've got...
Okay, Senator Byer does have a couple questions here that he'd like to ask.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, Ralph or Russ, the $5 million figure you use for 6,000 acres of 20-year-old timber seems really low to me.
Did I say 500? I think I said 5 million.
You said 5 million, yeah. But that figure seems...
This is site 3 and 4 ground. It's not like your ground. It's site 2 and 1.
Okay.
And these weren't Christmas trees.
No, I understand. Another question would be, last week when the Department of Fish and Wildlife was here, they talked about the fact that some private landowners in the state applied for funds to the Access and Habitat Board to rehabilitate land on that was burned this year. And they had a figure of, I think it was 7,000 acres or something like that, was rehabilitated with their help. And I'm curious, did you guys apply for any of that money, and if not, why not, I guess would be the answer to the question.
We will, but we just went ahead and did it. We replaced all the structures in Flat Creek. The salmon were back this year. They found a good home. Steelhead came back. We will finish the fire salvage by August of next year. We're planting right now in the burned area. We should have the planting done by 1995.
Yeah, it was sort of disappointing from my narrow perspective because I thought it presented a much better example before Russ had the stream improvement projects replaced because it showed what the fire did. But now that he's already put them back in, it'll be better for the fish. But fortunately, we'll just have to look at the pictures of how bad it was before.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I think this is important. The private timberland owners here, not only did they lose their value of their young forest, which is, you know, no salvage value, but in addition to replanting the trees, you've gone back at your own expense and replaced the structures in the streams there. And I mean, that, I think that says a lot. And I don't know, you don't have a, didn't give a figure for what you spent in addition to firefighting resources, replanting trees, lost value, but also rehabilitating streams. I mean, who knows how many millions that is.
Ralph and I have actually talked about this in the office. I mean, even if you just used the state's approach rather than the federal government's approach to fighting fires, this could have been avoided.
You see that?
Yeah.
The back page of your handout tells a lot, too.
Thanks. Any other questions?
No.
Thank you very much. We still have several people who've signed up this morning, but I want to start with Scott Ashgram, who asked to go late on the agenda this morning. So let's ask Scott to come up. We're going to try to hold everybody to 5 minutes or less in the remaining period of time that we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Scott Ashgram, representing today the Oregon Agriculture Alliance, which is a new small organization made up of 20 relatively large agricultural producers and growers in the state of Oregon, statewide. And I represent the Yamhill County Improvement District, which is a farmers' improvement district in Yamhill County, which accounts for about 6,000 acres of farmland right on the main stem of the Willamette River at River Mile 64. I'm going to go very rapidly to stay within the 5 minute framework. Of course, the major focus of this session is going to be the budget. In that debate, OAA will support fee increases proposed by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The OAA will support a continuation of civil penalty authority for the Department of Agriculture. We will support fee increases for water right applications by the Water Resources Department. And the rationale behind us supporting these fee increases is that program cuts are often proposed in times of revenue shortfall that affect programs which benefit the industry, such as the issuance of water rights, the issuance of permits, the nursery license program, nursery stock inspection program, agriculture inspection programs. They benefit users. We believe that users should pay their own way and account for revenues in the budget cut environment that way. We also intend to work for restoration of proposed cuts in the higher education budget for OSU extension and research services, which benefit agriculture. We are very concerned with a number of policy issues that will be before this legislature. I'll run through just a few of those. There will be legislation. I don't know if it'll come to your committee or to another committee in the Senate and House that deals with determining the navigability of streams. So this is a complicated issue. It is being politically forced by a number of salmon interests before the land board, and you're going to see a major legislation with regard to determination of stream navigability. This is a huge issue. We will be working with the legislature to try to get a rational solution to these legitimate problems and concerns. The pesticide use reporting system, this is a large policy question for agriculture. The program, which is in ODA, has not been funded due to a revenue shortfall in the last interim. We need to come up with an adequate way to fund that program. We'll be working to bring that about. Another huge policy area is land use planning. We have, of course, a critical concern over the retention of farmland and farm use, particularly in the Willamette Valley, but statewide. There will be a bill with a lot of political steam behind it, having to do with establishing high-tech industrial lands, and the proposal really is aimed at getting around the farmland protection laws to some degree to allow expedited establishment of high-tech farmlands, predominantly in the Tri-County area, but you're talking about some good farmland up there that might be the target of some of these proposals to convert them to a non-farm use high-tech. We need to make sure that program is done in a rational manner that protects the Oregon environment. You're going to see a huge bill having to do with farm labor relations. The Farm Bureau, the Oregon Association of Nurserymen, and NORPAC have hired attorneys to draft a farm labor relation bill. You'll hear about that from others, but this is going to be very big issue, I think, and we have to be pretty close to that as well. In conclusion, these are two very abstract issues, and we have no proposal at this time as to how they can be addressed. But you just heard from the representatives from Boise Cascade of the difficulty in dragging the federal government to the table and dragging them into a productive dialogue with the state of Oregon and with producers in the state of Oregon. If a process could be developed, an ongoing process to facilitate a dialogue and interaction between federal natural resource management agencies in Oregon and the state of Oregon and individual natural resource companies in the state of Oregon, I think that you would move along ways in the direction of rationalizing management of Oregon's natural resources. That's something which is an ongoing project to try to come up with a process to do that. Finally, it would be nice if the legislature could come up with an actual definition of the public. It could come up with a definition of what constitutes the public interest. Because by not having a rational definition of the public and the public interest, a number of natural resource management policies are really left to the discretion of ministerial personnel in agencies, and they come up with the determination of what constitutes the public interest. Now, that's a huge policy question. We have no solutions at this time to offer you, but it's something that this legislature, sooner or later, we believe should address. That concludes my comments. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
Thank you for sharing with us, Scott. As I've said over and over again, just keep coming back at us.
Really? Okay.
Thanks. I've got Steve Cafori down here. I want to invite Steve to come up and share for a couple minutes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafori. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm going to be representing a number of advocacy organizations this session in a wide variety of areas, construction, healthcare, and environmental issues. But there is one organization I represent that I wanted to talk just very briefly about this morning and offer some assistance to the committee. That's an organization called the Wildlife Society. It's not an advocacy organization. It's a scientific society of wildlife biologists. Our members come from a wide variety of backgrounds. They're academicians. They are staff people at state and federal agencies. They work for timber companies. They work for power companies. They are private consultants, a wide variety of viewpoints represented. This organization's basic function is to educate itself and the public on new developments in wildlife biology. The reason we come to the legislature is, as I said, we're not an advocacy organization. We take no position supporting or opposing any initiatives that have come before the legislature. But what we do want to do is to bring some scientific information, and we offer ourselves as a resource. We'll be testifying on bills that have to do with wildlife biology, and we'd like to offer ourselves between bills if the committee or staff have any questions that they want to know. There's going to be some contentious issues I foresee coming up this session on wildlife biology, and as I say, we don't have answers in terms of advocacy, but we think we can provide some science that will allow, when you make policy decisions, allow you to be making those policy decisions within a scientific framework.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. And we'll keep track of you as we hope you'll keep track of us. Gene Wilkinson is here somewhere. Ah, come on down. Yeah, where's Barry? Oh, there he is. She actually ran out in the hall looking for you a second ago.
I didn't see him.
We were saying, where'd the Farm Bureau go? You know. And while she was out looking, I called Steve in. Sorry we didn't find you quicker.
It's okay. It's nice to know somebody that I'm actually able to hide with my size.
We're not going to go there.
Okay. Chairman Shields and members of the committee, I am Barry Beshew, full-time farmer out of Boring, Oregon, and also president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Joining me is Gene Wilkinson from our governmental affairs team. Don Schellenberg sends his regards from Washington, D.C., where he's working on agricultural issues at the national level, and Greg Addington is at another meeting. Farm Bureau has a number of issues it will be pursuing during this legislative session. They all share a common theme and are developed as part of our policy development process that reflects the concerns and issues affecting our grassroots membership. We are concerned about the viability of the agricultural industry in the state and believe it is an integral and crucial part of the state's economy. Much of our legislative agenda works to reduce unnecessary, onerous, and costly regulations that add to the economic burden we already bear. We strive to protect the ability of farmers to continue to farm. We are proud of our efforts on issues including but not limited to the environment, land use, navigability, transportation, and a host of others. And I think it would be fair to say we probably share the concerns mentioned earlier by the Oregon Association of Nurserymen with regard to pesticide use, building some parameters around the agricultural labor situation, and a host of other issues including water. Like everyone else, we are concerned about the state's budget. Less than 1.5% of the general fund goes towards natural resources, and yet it contributes a considerably larger percentage of that to the economy. We hope the legislature will continue to consider this and help us to maintain long-standing and proven programs that we rely upon. With your help, we look forward to working with the new head of the Department of Agriculture, Oregon State University, and other agencies to strengthen agriculture. We are also committed to working with Governor Kulongoski on issues related to agriculture and helping to bridge the urban-rural divide. It is in the interest of all Oregonians to understand the value of agriculture to the economy, environment, and the aesthetics of Oregon. Farm Bureau's governmental affairs team is very committed and dedicated to agriculture. I hope you take advantage of their knowledge and expertise to help you better understand your issues. At this time, I would like to ask Jane to cover some of the concerns that she has on our behalf.
Chairman Shields, members of the committee, again, I'm Jean Underhill Wilkinson, Associate Director for Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. Do you want to hand out the... We have just a couple of sheets that you can have that explains or just lists very briefly our legislative agenda and some of the substantial issues we are planning on working on this session. Since we're out of time, you know, I won't go through those things. I'll just mention a couple of items. You've heard here today some mention and conversation about commodity commissions. You've heard also about navigability, and I think pesticide use reporting has been mentioned as well. Those are, among other items, those are some of the things we're working on currently. Commodity commissions, as most of you know, have run into some pretty substantial legal problems across the nation. And in Oregon, the agriculture community is attempting to fix those legal problems. Of course, it has to do with the fact that commodity commissions charge mandatory assessments, and there's been litigation about that, and commissions need to be operating in certain ways that they're not currently all doing here in Oregon in order to continue charging those mandatory assessments. Well, there are some concerns in the agriculture industry, and some of our membership has approached the Farm Bureau and said, can we do some additional analysis and to look at our options, because the remedies that are out there to fix those legal problems include more government interaction with commodity commissions and less control by the producer community. And that has raised some concerns, although there are legal
technical problems that need to be fixed this session. So as it stands right now, the Oregon Farm Bureau is not supporting the current bill that is going to be dropped. However, we are working very quickly in order to analyze the situation, do our own research, and put our membership in a position where they're comfortable. So again, we totally anticipate that a bill needs to be passed this session, but we're working diligently. We hope to have our analysis completed next week. Navigability. It's something that the Farm Bureau has been involved with for many, many years, and more recently we've had the state doing navigability studies on some of the major rivers in the state, which means the state assumes ownership of private property along these rivers. We're now in a negotiating situation with the state treasurer, Randall Edwards, and we are currently working on a proposal that would identify certain rivers and allow public recreation access to those rivers, and in exchange for that, the state would not complete or not initiate navigability studies on rivers in the state for 4 years until this pilot program that we're proposing on identified rivers in the state has a chance to go forward and to identify any additional issues having to do with public access and public use of the banks, beds and banks of these rivers identified. So right now we're in a process of getting public feedback on our proposal, and we're hoping that we can go forward with that this legislative session. Pesticide use reporting, then I'm done. Pesticide use reporting is something that the Farm Bureau and the agriculture community has worked on for a number of years now. And, of course, as you know, there is some problems with the state's statutory obligation to fund administration of that program to a substantial degree. And there is problems with receiving that funding this biennium. So we're working very diligently to get a feel from our membership as to how they want to handle that problem, and working on looking at our options in that regard. And I would definitely expect legislation to be dealing with that program this session, and might be introduced in this committee. Thank you very much. Yes. Look forward to working with you.
Questions? Any questions? Thank you very much. Last but not least, I need to say that. Ed Johnston? You scribbled a note so quickly that I couldn't read your last name.
That happens sometimes when I scribble real fastly. Good morning. My name is Edward Johnston from Lincoln County. And also, too, I'm the one responsible and made sure with the Oregon State Employees Association that the Lincoln County recall did happen in Lincoln County. So the voters did have a say. The one thing I've heard today dealing with public lands do not pose a threat to private lands. The public is the one who takes the burden on private lands because we give the tax breaks. And I would like to see to make sure that the public still ends up with the right-of-ways on public lands as well as private lands that have been established, so we don't lose those rights. The one thing that I have, the other thing is, with private concerns and the deep forest of privatizing our deep forest, the public, I would assume, does not want that to happen because the public still wants the right of way for their hunting and fishing, and we need to preserve that. The other thing is, public is defined by the taxpayers. So the public and right of ways of the taxpayers are the ones who have the say what's going on, and they ought to be listened to. And in closing, dealing with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife asking for increase of fees, I definitely say they should be denied any increase of fees because they overspent their budget by $6.5 million. And Chair Shields, I was able to produce that in some of the packages I did at several other hearings that actually had their own statements of their overspending of their budget. So, and also, too, I would recommend across the state a 25% pay decrease for all administrators that got the pay raises this last year to help with their budget crisis, because, like, the bus drivers and those people should not be the ones burdened of losing their jobs when the administrators who are making over $80,000 to $150,000 are the ones who should share that burden, not the little guys who are making $15 or $10 an hour. We need to do a serious balance of what our state is doing for the public compared to self-preserve and personal interest. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, we've covered a lot of territory this morning, and a lot of people have come and gone. I
appreciate all the information. I know it came from a multiplicity of backgrounds. And we may do this again later in the fall or later in the spring. Huh? What did you say?
What happened to Dave Nelson?
Dave had to leave. He did not necessarily come to speak. Dave was here in case there were questions about the Commodity Commission, some of their concepts. If there's no further business, we're adjourned.